Hello. Hello and welcome. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I am the subject collector for English and American Poetry, and I more or less manage these event series as well, the Colloquia series, the Writer series, and the film series. First and foremost, some logistics, as you noticed in the weigh-in, there are books for sale, and Natasha has nicely agreed to sign books after the discussion. I'm just going to say a few words and then introduce Anita Skeen, who's really responsible for making all this happen. So first of all, thank you, Anita, and to the Residential College of Arts and Humanities. I'm the subject collector for English American Literature, but I'm also the liaison for the Residential College of Arts and Humanities. Wow. Okay, sorry. First of all, just a few words on why the library has events, to advertise collections and services of the library. I could go on about English and American poetry, but I'll just say very briefly that the Digital Multimedia Center, which is right down the hallway, records just about all of our events. And so in not too long of a time, you can actually look up this event in the library catalog, and it will be streamed so you can listen to it remotely. We do that for just about all the colloquia events and all the writers' events that we have. So if you want more information on that, just let me know or ask somebody in the DMC, and they'll escort you to the proper place in the catalog. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Anita Skeen, who is the Arts Coordinator for Residential College and Arts and Humanities and the Director for the Center of Poetry, and she'll say a few words and introduce Natasha, and away we go. Please welcome Anita.
Thanks, Michael. It's the introducer who introduces the introducer who introduces the main act. I want to say thanks to Michael and to the library for hosting us for this event, because this is taking place in the daytime, and we expected a larger crowd than we normally have at our afternoon conversations. We had no available space in the RCAH for this, so they've been gracious to welcome us over here and to record this momentous event in the history of the Poetry Center. Thanks go out to the Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives for sponsoring this event and providing the funding, along with the Dean Steve Esquith and the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. My other thanks goes out to the staff of the Poetry Center, Linnea Jemison, who's the assistant director here, and I see two of our interns, Kelsey Block and Jenny Crakes, who really are they're the steam behind the engine. I may look like the engine, but if I didn't have them, the engine would just be sitting on the tracks. So they put their heart and soul into these events, and we're grateful to that. Just two quick announcements about this is the first event in our annual Spring Poetry Festival. These will be followed on two consecutive Wednesdays, although this is Thursday, but our other events are done on Wednesdays. And next Wednesday, we will have Tracy K. Smith for both an informal conversation in the afternoon, where she'll be talking about the power of the image in contemporary poetry and the use of the image. And then that night, she'll be reading from her work. She's the winner of the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for her book Life on Mars, and has done many other things too. She will be followed the next Wednesday, April 16th, by Sophia Starnes, the Poet Laureate of Virginia, who will be talking about who will have an informal conversation in the afternoon too, where she'll be talking about a statement made by the poet Czesław Miłosz, who said, "Language is my country." And she wants to talk about language and how writers use language and why on earth he would say such a thing as that. That will be her afternoon talk, and then she'll be reading again in the RCH Theater at 7 o'clock in the evening. I also should say, Linnea reminded me of this, that Sophia and I will be on Current State that morning, April 16th at 9 o'clock, doing a little interview. So if you want to listen into that and get a preview of Sophia, please feel free to tune in. Now, I don't want to give the same introduction to Natasha that I gave last night, and many of you were there. And I think listening to her talk and to our conversation, she won't need much introduction. We know she's the 19th Poet Laureate of the United States, and we're very grateful to have her in that position. I'm even more grateful that I'm grateful for a lot of reasons, but after I heard her read last night, I was even more grateful. I had the privilege of hearing her over at Grand Valley State University several years ago when she read with Paul Muldoon, and at that point I thought, we need this person. And then she wasn't even the Poet Laureate, so we have her now. But I will say something about her books, which read individually or collectively are a real treat. Domestic Work, her first book, won the Cawey Connum Prize for Poetry. That was followed by Biloxophilia, which is a wonderful book of poems, written, some letter poems, some in the voice of prostitutes living in the red light district in New Orleans that were photographed by Balak. And if you don't know anything about his work, his photographs were not published until the 1960s, I think, right?
I think the first edition of them was in 1970 or the mid-70s.
Yeah, he sort of did this in secret, and not many people knew about it, and the glass plates were found. So very interesting and very powerful book. That was followed by Native Guard, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, and her most recent book, Thrall, which has not been out all that long, and is a wonderful book. As I said, you read these books individually, and they are powerful, but when you start in the beginning and read through to the end, and you see the interweaving of personal life and public life, the interweaving of historical events and critical moments in this nation's life, and the struggle, I think, in all of them for equality and social justice and for giving voice to various people who often don't have those voices. It's a powerful read. So today, what we're going to do, I'm going to serve as the asker of the questions. And last night, we handed out cards at the reading for people to write some questions on. And of course, I had some questions too. And I'm teaching a course this semester in the Poets Laureate. How convenient. And we also had some questions. So I'm hoping to get a kind of conversation going here with us, and then we'll probably carry this on for about 40 minutes or so, and then Natasha has graciously agreed to sign some books afterwards. So I want to start with a Poets Laureate question, because I happen to know that one of my students came up to you last night and said to you, I'd never even heard of a Poet Laureate until 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And she was asking this morning, should I have said that or not? And I said, no, I think that was a great way to say how glad you are now that you know about the Poets Laureate. So, you know, I wanted to ask you that you follow in the footsteps of some of America's most beloved poets. I think right off about Robert Frost and Gwendolyn Brooks, mm-hmm. who are probably names that the general population knows more than they do. Some names of some other wonderful poets I think of, like Robert Hayden and Louise Bogan, who aren't as well known. And I wonder what you would say about the legacies that these poets have left for you, and how being a part of this tradition makes you feel about your own work and some of the things you'd like to do in that position.
That's a good question now that I'm at the end of my term. Because I've already done a lot of it.
You've done it.
So I'll talk about that. You know, the two of the former, consultants, really. They were consultants before the Act of Congress changed the name to Poets Laureate in 1985. Both Gwendolyn Brooks and Robert Penn Warren were consultants. And then Gwendolyn Brooks was actually the last consultant, and Robert Penn Warren was asked to come back for a second term, this time as the first laureate, mm-hmm. in 1986. He was also the first Southerner, the first Southern laureate. It's been since he was there until now that I'm there that there's been a Southerner in that office. But both of their legacies were important to me, and Gwendolyn Brooks in particular, because when I set out to undertake a kind of project. You know, one of the things that they've done differently now is that if a laureate is interested in doing a national project, then the term can be extended for a second year. If the person chooses just to accept the honor and not actually do a kind of national service project, they just do 1 year. Mm-hmm. So you know, I imagined that I wanted to do a project, and but you know, you're not sitting around every day thinking, well, when they call me to be the laureate, this is what my project's going to be. So you don't actually have one, and there have been so many wonderful projects that have come before that have meant a lot to me that, you know, it's sort of hard to think of some. You know, one of my favorites is Robert Pinsky's favorite poem project. You know about that, when he got people to record themselves reading and then talking about a favorite poem, proving yet again how many people do turn to poetry for various reasons and even keep it in mind. Also, Billy Collins' project, Poetry 180, you know, bringing poetry into the public schools. Brodsky's poetry in grocery stores and in buses and places like that. Kay Ryan went to community colleges for her project. What I did my first term, so I've actually kind of had two projects, and the first one was kind of accidental, but I decided that I wanted to move to Washington and hold office hours in the laureate's office at the Library of Congress. And no one had done that since it was still a job, and that was Gwendolyn Brooks. Mm-hmm. And so it's been kind of old school for me to go and do that and be open to not only people in the district, but people who travel from other states to come to the library and have a conversation with me about poetry.
Was it Elizabeth Bishop who said she felt like she sat in that office and drank sherry all day? and that was before poets started doing projects.
That's right.
She was kind of tired of being alone drinking sherry.
Yeah, but they kind of had to be a librarian and to be there and answer letters and that kind of thing.
And so, Ted Kooser, I think, wrote letters and letters and letters and letters.
Oh, he's written me lots of them, too. He's wonderful. Ted Kooser was, I think, probably the first former laureate to get in touch with me with wonderful advice about what to do and not to do.
And does that pan out? Was he right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
He's very good. You know, one of the things that he wrote to me about, you know, and I was, you know, coming on the heels of one of my favorite poets, Phil Levine, who is passionately political, and he speaks his mind, and he's earned every bit of the right to be able to do that. And I love this about him. But, you know, there are certain things that the librarian and the Library of Congress would not want laureates to say, because you don't want to anger Congress too much. So, you know, Phil could be known for saying those kinds of things, but Ted Kooser wrote to me and reminded me that, you know, whereas we are political, you know, each of us has our own politics, and I think no poet can completely get rid of those. You bring them to your work. But there's a different way of thinking about the post itself, that the post of poet laureate and poetry itself need not feel partisan. You need not feel that it's only available to certain people, mm-hmm. or certain kinds of people, or people with certain kinds of beliefs. And so I will admit this to you. Early on in my time at the library, when I moved to Washington, they got a call from Fox News, and Chris Wallace wanted to interview me as a power player of the week. A poet now, power player of the week in Washington, D.C. You bet they wanted me to do this interview. But when the head of the Poetry and Literature Center asked me to do it, I thought, there's no way I can go on Fox News and talk about poetry. And that has a lot to do with my own leanings. But then I thought about it, and I thought about Ted Kooser's advice. And what it made me realize is that if my job as poet laureate is to promote poetry to as wide an audience as possible, I can't discount the portion of the population that gets its news from Fox. I want to bring poetry to everyone. So I did it.
And how was it?
It was great. It was good. Although I did feel like there were some funny moments in the whole thing, but they stayed with me the whole day, and I was doing a lecture on Whitman and the Civil War. They filmed that. So it was good. But you know how you know, you get mic'd and everything. Mm-hmm. They want to mic you early on. And I said, no, that's not a good idea, because you could forget that it was on, like a lot of politicians
do. Like a lot of people have done.
So I didn't want that to happen. So I refused that part.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Here's a question I want to ask you that might get political, but I'm going to ask it anyway. As we know, many of us know, there are only 6 states in the United States that do not have a poet laureate, mm-hmm. and Michigan is one of them. Mm. And Michigan has never had a poet laureate. Some states have poet laureateships that are vacant right now, but there are actually 6 states that have never had one. And not that it hasn't been brought up, but it's been felt that that was not a necessary addition to state government or whatever. There are a number of us here now who are wanting to rev up the move to get a poet laureate for the state of Michigan. And I wonder what advice you might have for us about how to go about that.
Wow.
Big question.
Yeah, that is a tough question.
I mean, I think there are the political mechanisms we have to go through to do that,
right.
But we also, we are gaining grassroots support.
And what's the opposition to it?
Money. Well, it has been
money?
A Republican administration in some cases.
I was appointed poet laureate of the state of Mississippi by a Republican governor, by the way. What are the other states that don't have them?
New Mexico. Arizona, of course, just got Alberto Rios, which I want to ask you something about later on. I didn't bring my list with me, but I just looked this morning to be sure, and there were only 6. What's another state that starts with it? What's right? It must be New Hampshire, because they're right together. New Mexico, New Hampshire. Pennsylvania. I believe Ohio.
Wow. To think that Ohio had Rita Dove come from there and no state poet laureate, and to think that Maxine Cummins lived in New Hampshire and they have no poet laureate.
And of course, Pennsylvania.
I would be ashamed.
Pennsylvania doesn't have a poet laureate because they had Amiri Baraka, who offended the United States Senate.
That wasn't New Jersey? Oh,
you're right. That was New Jersey. That wasn't Pennsylvania. That was New Jersey. And so they didn't have in their provision a way to get rid of him, so they got rid of the position. So, you know, there's a lot going on with poet laureateships.
Why? Because it was a lifetime appointment? It wasn't one that had
No, term. It was one of the, you know, some of them are termed, some of them are lifetime, and his was a lifetime appointment. So they
Well, that doesn't seem like a good idea to me.
Did away with the laureateship. It's very interesting when you go looking at state poet laureates, how some of them are paid, some of them are not paid, some are paid travel. I mean, in your role as Mississippi, poet laureate of Mississippi, mm-hmm. are there stipulations put on you for projects you need to do, or are you sort of given free rein of what to do?
There are no stipulations about projects. I mean, they certainly want me to come and do events, but they've dealt with knowing how busy I am doing mm-hmm. things for the nation. But what I have noticed about some state laureateships is that it is written into the bylaws that the laureate would perhaps write poems for state occasions. Now, that's the tricky part. The Poet Laureate of the United States is not asked to write any poems for any occasions. And so you are free to be the kind of poet that you are, to say the things that you say, to write about the things that you write about, and not be expected to do anything that you disagree with. I think that even though that's in the bylaws of the Mississippi laureateship, they wouldn't actually ask me to write any you know, poems.
Sort of harkens back to England.
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
that's what some of the state laureateships I know mm-hmm. about are like.
Mm-hmm. Some of them ask for, you know, 2 public readings in the state during the year. Some mm-hmm. of them ask for appearances in public schools. But it's very different. But we have a large writing base in Michigan, a large community mm-hmm. of poets. We have cities. We have Detroit. We have Grand Rapids. We have Lansing. And there are enough people here who I think are ready to start some noise about having a poet laureate. And
well, you know, I think that they need only watch in my second year project, what I've been doing is going around the country with Jeff Brown of the PBS NewsHour, doing a series of segments called Where Poetry Lives. And my goal was just to answer some of those critics that I hear again and again, and usually you hear them most loudly in April, Hearkening the Death of Poetry, How No One Cares About Poetry. This is when they make that claim. And so my answer to that is to go around the country and show ordinary people making use of poetry in their daily lives, in particular to deal with various societal issues. So the first one was in New York at the Brooklyn Memory Center, and we showed a poet who was using poetry to help Alzheimer's patients live in the moment. We also went to Harvard Medical School, and Rafael Campo is the poet there, who is also a physician on the faculty, and he believes in teaching a poetry workshop to the young doctors there because he thinks that it will help them be more empathetic and able to treat the whole patient. We also went to Detroit and with Terry Blackhawk and the Inside Out Literary Arts program that sends poets into the inner city schools, middle schools, to teach poetry. And this was the most meaningful one for me so far. I got to sit there and talk with the whole class, and then specifically an interview with three of the students, two boys and a girl. And at some point I asked them, what would you do if you had my job, if you had to convince people who don't think that they like poetry that poetry can matter in their lives? And the young girl said, well, first of all, I'd read them a poem. And then she said, and then I talked to them a little bit about what poetry is, because if they don't like it, they must not know what it is. And I thought she should be the poet laureate because that is the best answer. But all of
she's
them,
already got her project.
She's already
up.
Got it. But they all talked about what it meant for them in their lives and how it changed things and what they loved about language. And I think if someone watched that, there'd be no way they wouldn't want to have a laureate, a representative who might do that kind of work that gets that out of the kids. And you know, one hates to have to mention things like this, but I'm just going to say it anyway. The principal of the school was a little skeptical at first, mm-hmm. and now he loves this program. He thinks it's the greatest thing, and the Inside Out people have been tracking the students' progress. I mean, we have to deal with test taking because that's what they've given us. But what they found is that the students who'd gone through that poetry program are doing better on those standardized tests they're forced to take than not. Than the ones who've not.
Yeah, I think that's not surprising to any of us, but people don't seem to connect. You know, one of the missions of the Poetry Center is to connect poetry to people's daily lives. Mm-hmm. And I think many people feel that it's totally removed from their daily lives, mm-hmm. and it has nothing to do with them when it has everything in the world to do with them. And it can also help them through the times that they don't know how to get through. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that leads a little bit to one of the questions I wanted to ask. I was reading, some of you have not seen the interview with Natasha that's in the September, October, I think 2010, it came out a long time ago, 2012 issue of Poets and Writers. This is one of my favorite articles that's been written about yeah. you. Yeah, I like it. I like the information that's in here.
Really? I didn't read it. And I mean, I try not to, but I didn't particularly enjoy the interview, so I haven't gone back to.
Well, there's some interesting, you know, from a perspective of a teacher, there's some wonderful things, there's some wonderful teaching tools in that article. And one of the things,
good to know.
he quotes your father as saying about you, in any case, one of the things I told her from the very beginning was that anyone can write poems, but that she was particularly gifted because she had a big subject, which is something that not everyone has. She just had to learn how to write about that big subject. I think the subject he was referring to, of course, was race. And I think many poets are born into big subjects. I mean, the fact that we're born into history and into particular times when things are happening, We are born with big subjects around us, but we don't know many times until we've been writing for years and years and years how to get to those subjects. I think you got to that subject early and figured out how to deal with a particularly volatile and particularly painful and particularly controversial topic. And you did it in ways that drew people in rather than alienated them. And so I wondered if you could just speak a little bit about that.
Well, I'm glad to know that he got my father saying that, because that is something my father said to me for as long as I can remember. I mean, I was a little girl, and he was telling me that Well, he told me I needed to be either a politician or a poet.
That, I'm glad you went the poetry route.
Well, and I think in some ways, you know, a little bit of that, you know, at least being diplomatic is part of being a poet laureate. But, you know, he said that to me, and I grew up thinking that that was important, and that's why you'd want to do this, because you have, he would say, because you have something important to say. This is what he would actually say to me. But then you hear quite the opposite. I remember listening to, I think it's Maureen Corrigan. She's a wonderful reviewer on NPR. She usually reviews novels for them, and she teaches at Georgetown. I remember hearing her one day telling this story that we know as creative writing teachers, that if a student comes to you and says they have something important to say, you discourage that student. But if the student comes to you and says, I love fooling around with language, that's the one you encourage, because somehow you want to privilege that over what you have to say.
Content.
Well, and my father told me just the opposite. Uh-huh. And I'm glad he did. Because he, you know, I did know that it meant it simply wasn't experience. You know, having experience, as my father says, everyone can be a poet. Well, everyone has experience, has history, is born into a particular geography, and geography is fate, you know, as Heraclitus reminds us. But figuring out how to do it in language that is compelling and interesting to other people, that is the trick.
Yeah. So getting, I mean, I always think about your work as exactly the right word in the right place at the right time. And it seems, language seems to be a difficult thing. People do tend to think about the content, and they think about the structure of the poem. Mm-hmm. Lots of times they think about how it looks on the page before they're actually thinking about the words that they're putting down there. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think about something that Phil Levine said, that in an interview, that he wanted his poems to be like perfectly clear windows through which you could look and see very clearly the people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from that, I take something that's important to me. I've always been more interested in people than in words. Words become the medium to examine our lives and our history. But I still place that as more important.
So, but do you think you have to love language to be a poet?
Oh, I think you do. Uh-huh. But I don't love it just for the sake of playing around with it.
Mm-hmm. The window analogy that you brought up, one of the questions we got last night from someone in the audience was this. I wrote it down. It has to do with writing about photographs. What is it like for you to write from historical photographs, such as the poems in Biloxophilia and Domestic Work? How do you create that character's voice and motivation and story when you're inventing that person?
Hmm. Well, you know, I think you have to give to a persona or a character a lot of your own interior life. You know, I think about what Kundera wrote in The Unbearable Lightness of Being, that all of his characters are unrealized parts of himself. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's perhaps the most important thing, because it means that you can really empathize with a character. If you can't empathize, I think it would be hard to make the character real. An individual human being with, you know, flaws and all the things that are necessary to have a fully realized humanity. When I was working on my very first book, Domestic Work, I was writing about my maternal grandmother in the third person, based on a lot of stories that she told me about all the jobs she'd held. And I remember when I gave her the book finally, she sat down and read it, and of course I had taken these bits of her stories but infused them with, you know, aspects of my own interior life, of I think ways that we connected to each other, but things that I had to imagine because I couldn't know everything she had been thinking or feeling. So I gave it to her, and she read it straight through, and she said, "It's all about me." And then she said, "And that's just how it was." And I really felt that I had, you know, I had invented her for herself in a way that seemed genuine to her.
Yeah, that's that's quite a feat to have her say that and not say, well, you know, in this poem, I really didn't do.
Yeah, right.
I was not wearing a blue dress when this happened.
None of that.
None of that.
Yeah.
You know, that makes me think also, one of the other questions I wanted to ask you about was family. I think it's very tough to write about family, whether you're writing in a memoir, whether you're writing in poetry, whether you're changing those characters into fiction because family members say, well, you didn't put me in this novel, or else they say, well, you put me in this novel, and you can't seem to please them. But I think writing about family is hard for a lot of reasons. Mm. One of my favorite family poems is a Robert Hayden poem, and it's that poem, Those Winter Sundays. Mm-hmm. Do you all know that poem? Yes, it is powerful. I also think of Theodore Radke's poem, My Papa's Waltz. Mm-hmm. And of the two, I love Hayden's poem the most, but I love how they both do what they do. And they show us people who are flawed, people who are not perfect, but people who have love. And that seems to get them through. And when I think about your writing about family, it's very similar to that. I also think about Rita Dove and Thomason Beulah, mm-hmm. which we just read some of those poems in my class today. And those are wonderful poems. And she's nailed it, you know? Yeah. And could you just talk a little bit about writing about family?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny that you mentioned those two poems and that book and my father, because early on, when I first went to graduate school, my father was one of my first teachers of poetry. I'd never taken a poetry workshop as an undergraduate, and so I was in his class in graduate school.
And courage.
Well, I think I was too naive to be afraid or to know any better. But my father, the earliest poems that he gave me to read and to imitate were the Hayden poem and the Rutke
no
poem.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. So it's almost as if he was saying, you know, here's a text for writing about me at some point. You know, because these are both father poems. So, and then when I went off to graduate school for my MFA, this was my MA when I was with my father, he gave me a copy of Rita Dove's Thomason Beulah, and I carried it around with me. It was sort of a poetry Bible for me. And that's in some ways how I figured out how to write the sequence in domestic work from reading about the interior lives of her grandparents.
Yeah, I think it's so easy when you write about family. And what I think we find in students who are writing about family is that they're either so sentimental because of the love, or they're so angry.
Yeah.
The poems are so angry because of injustices and things like that.
Well, and that was, you know, that was really hard for me working on Thrall to balance that swirl of emotion, you know. And that's a book that is hard on my father. I mean, he's said as much, you know.
Yeah.
There was a moment when I started writing some of those poems, and I wasn't telling him about it, and he would see them in magazines. So he saw the poem Elegy for the first time in a magazine, and he said it was a beautiful poem, but, you know, we argue about it because he says it presents him as not a good fisherman. I mean,
that's what he's worried about.
And that's what I say. I mean, out of all everything in that poem, what you're worried about is looking like you couldn't catch a fish that day. And then he wants to tell me that it wasn't trout that I caught, it was guppies. And, you know, I've been like, Daddy, I've caught trout before. I know what they look like. But he, I had been sort of hiding it. And then he knew that I had the book in galleys. And so one day, when I couldn't not show it to him, he asked me if he could read it. And I let him read it. And when I saw him afterwards, he said, it's a beautiful book. But it's sad. And I said, well, it was sad when I was living it. Mm-hmm. And I think what hurts him most about it, Well, I think it's a combination of seeing himself presented in a way that he'd perhaps not like to see himself, mm-hmm. but also seeing what might have hurt me that he didn't intend to hurt me with, but that it did still. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned yesterday in the reading, feeling like when we stand together, that I was the Venus Hottentot whenever he'd get to a certain line in a particular poem. And it took me 40 years to figure out what bothered me about, you know, my father's line in that poem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some elements of, you know, I was saying earlier about writing persona poems, some elements of my relationship with my father came out even in Belloc's Ophelia, because I said, you know, you have to give to your character something of your interior life. So when I was a little girl, once my parents got divorced, I would go back in the summers to see my father. And, you know, I think it was perhaps a gesture that has happened in other families. Maybe, you know, it's just a fatherly thing, checking, you know. But my father, one of the first things he'd do when we got into the car was grab my hand and turn it over and look to see if my fingernails were clean. And, you know, certainly that's a fatherly type gesture, but there was something about the inspection and then the grabbing of my ears. It was something about the inspection that in this country, at that historical moment, the black daughter of a white father in Mississippi could not fail to see the connections mm-hmm. to a kind of difficult inspection.
Right.
And so I've lived with that, and it's something that I give to Ophelia. I give uh-huh. that trait to her, and a few other, you know, things like that. But I think it was my father didn't realize that those were about him until much later. I mean, he'd heard me read from the poems in that book, but never made the connection. I remember giving the reading and seeing his face at a moment that I think it actually occurred to him that I'd given to her something that I'd kept all those years.
It must be a difficult and wonderful thing to have a father who's a poet.
It is, yeah, it is absolutely both.
You have
and I think for him it's both too, to have difficult and wonderful to have a daughter who's a poet.
So many complexities in those relationships. And that also leads me to another question I wanted to ask you, which was about writing about difficult subjects. And, you know, and one of the things I think that you have mastered in some of your poems is the sonnet, because you read those poems the first time and you don't know they're sonnets. Mm-hmm. I read those poems for the first time and I didn't know they were sonnets until I went back to look at them. Also, the Pantoum, there's a couple that, you know, the echoing seems like echoing, but it doesn't necessarily seem like a fixed form until I get finished. And I was talking with my class earlier when we were looking at Sestinas mm-hmm. and talking about sometimes when you have difficult subjects to write about, the fixed form will hold you in mm-hmm. and not let the subject matter get away from you. Yeah. And so I Thrall is a freer mm-hmm. line book. So I wonder if you would just talk a little bit about writing in form and writing in freer verse. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I would have said exactly what you said. I've turned to form many times in order to, you know, put that elegant envelope around difficult subject matter. And it helps. For example, you know, I'd never written a sestina, and since you mention it, the last poem in my first book is not a sestina, but there was a day that I just couldn't deal with, you know, the material I was trying to deal with, so I forced myself to write a sestina, and once I finished it, I immediately wrote the poem that I kept. Uh-huh. And I think that the form, you know, did something to my thinking that allowed the poem I was really trying to write to happen. But, you know, in another time, the Pantoum incident, which is about the Klan burning the yeah. cross, it began as a very kind of pedestrian narrative lyric with its little, you know, epiphany at the end about that particular incident. And I knew it wasn't right. And so I took that and I decided that I was going to give it a fixed form to see what would happen. And what happened was, so I took this finished little narrative lyric over one side, and I decided to condense everything I'd written into four lines. We tell the story every year. how we peered through the windows, shades drawn, though nothing really happened, the charred grass now green again. I had four lines, and so then I said, well, now I'm gonna try a pantoum, which meant I had to take lines 2 and 4 and bring them down in positions 1 and 3 and then write a new 2 and 4 and so on. And it changed the nature of what the poem was about. So the poem was no longer simply focused on the incident of the cross burning. It was focused on the necessity for remembering.
Well, and the lamps, the oil lamps in there, I mean, that's one of my favorite parts of that poem is the lamps burning and the flame burning and the, what's the image?
With the wicks trembling in their fonts of oil.
In their fonts of oil, yeah. And that wasn't even in there then in those first four lines.
No.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's what comes, you know, what comes later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what you get to do with the pantoum, with those repeated lines, is they have to mean and then mean again. They mean differently. They're not the same. And that's one of the things that I loved about writing it. You know, how the line about the oil lamps changes subtly and what follows by mourning the flames it all dimmed. In one stanza, I'm talking about the flames of the wicks and the oil lamps. In the next stanza, I'm talking about the flames of the burning cross. Yeah. But it's the same line.
Yeah. And there are other flames also. I mean, you know, psychological and various kinds of things.
You know, and what I learned from, I think it was in that moment. I mean, I'd already been working on the crown of sonnets, that is the sequence, the title sequence, Native Guard. And that it started as an accident because I wouldn't say exactly an accident. I had become so used to writing in 10-syllable lines and in 14 lines and with a volta because of Belloc's Ophelia, because of Storyville Diary, that it was hard to break that. Uh-huh. That everything came to me in that shape. And so when I started writing The Native Guard, he came to me in that shape too, but I needed to distinguish him from Ophelia and all the different ways, the tools that I had to make him sound different. And one of the first sort of formal constraints that I put on myself at that point was to make it a crown. And so because it became a crown, it was necessary to, you know, repeat the last line of one sonnet as the beginning of another sonnet. And that is when it occurred to me the larger idea behind Native Guard, and that is in terms of historical memory and historical erasure, these things that have been, vanished from our landscape or have never been inscribed on our landscape in terms of monuments and memorials and the namings of roads and bridges, that it became necessary not just to say a thing, but to say it again. So repetition and refrain became the guiding formal constraint for the entire book, Native Guard, as well as a lot of the individual poems in it. But when I started writing Thrall, I just wanted to break out of the form. Yeah, I wanted to, you know, I remember talking to Bob Wrigley, who's a wonderful poet and a great friend of mine, and I told him this, and he said, well, why? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I knew that I needed to stretch out and hear something different. And so I tried in Thrall to return to what I thought of as a more syncopated sound that I was trying to do in my first book, Domestic Work, but I think I didn't quite know the line as well as I did by the time I wrote Thrall. Uh-huh. So I hear it, I hear that sound in both books. I see it differently in Thrall.
That's a great explanation. I want to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to ask you if, because some of the people here weren't at the reading last night, if you would end with a poem, reading a poem. But the question I want to ask is, what next? You know, you're about finished as the Poet Laureate, and I know you told me a little bit about a possible memoir, but where are you going next?
Well, just to be able to write again will be nice. I had begun research for another collection of poems before I was named Poet Laureate, so I hope to be able to get back to it. It is a collection, I think, that will take me back to Mississippi, to that geography that I can't get away from.
The geography is destiny.
Yeah,
I think that's true. Okay, well, pick a poem. What are you going to read to us?
Well, since we've talked so much about my father, I think I will just read Elegy then. Elegy for my father. I think by now the river must be thick with salmon. Late August, I imagine it as it was that morning, drizzle needling the surface, mist at the banks like a net settling around us, everything damp and shining. That morning, awkward and heavy in our hip waders, we stalked into the current and found our places, you upstream a few yards and out far deeper. You must remember how the river seeped in over your boots and you grew heavier with that defeat. All day I kept turning to watch you, how first you mimed our guide's casting, then cast your invisible line, slicing the sky between us. And later, rod in hand, how you tried again and again to find that perfect arc, flight of an insect skimming the river's surface. Perhaps you recall I cast my line and reeled in two small trout we could not keep. Because I had to release them, I confess I thought about the past, working the hooks loose, the fish writhing in my hands, each one slipping away before I could let go. I can tell you now that I tried to take it all in, record it for an elegy I'd write one day when the time came. Your daughter, I was that ruthless. What does it matter if I tell you I learned to be? You kept casting your line, and when it did not come back empty, it was tangled with mine. Some nights, dreaming, I step again into the small boat that carried us out and watch the bank receding, my back to where I know we are headed.
Well, thank you, Natasha Trethewey, for bringing us this gift on this dreary April Michigan day.
Thank you.